trying to make sure that they can hear us.
It's not on yet. That's a good one.
It should be.
Well, maybe there's something you turn, like a button.
Okay.
That's life.
Wait for it.
Okay.
You can't hear me, right? No.
No.
Okay, maybe there's a little button, you know, just like a button.
All right, let's see.
We're trying to hear it. Oh, water. That's good. Where's Mark?
Okay,
Mark,
mic,
it's, the mic's not on. Yeah. We're about to begin. It's on. Why don't you go first and check something?
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name's Ian. I'd like to welcome you along with Margaret. This is the opening session of the Historians Against the... Okay, let's try again. Is that better?
Okay, talk into the mic, I guess.
Okay. My name is Ian Fletcher, and I'm... I'd like to welcome you to the opening session of this weekend's Historians Against the War conference. And we are delighted to be co-sponsoring this event with the Peace History Society. We are here because of the help of an enormous number of people around the country and here in Georgia, here in Atlanta. And I'd like to start off by thanking some of the organizations which have provided so much vital support for building this conference and making it the success that it is already and will be through the rest of the weekend. The first thanks must go to Radio Free Georgia, which is our Pacifica-affiliated community radio station, WRFG 89.3 FM, our official media sponsor. We've received a tremendous amount of support from grassroots activist organizations, among them the Georgia Peace and Justice Coalition, Veterans for Peace, and the beautiful banners that are displayed outside, although they tell a very sad message, nevertheless, they are bright and demanding, as we all should be, about ending this war. American Friends Service Committee provided them. There are so many other groups to mention. Let me just say the United States Human Rights Network, based here in Atlanta. And Amnesty International USA. It is a privilege to be in the South. This is a region, a land of great struggle, and I would like to call attention to one of the bright struggles that is opening up as we speak at the University of Georgia, just about 70 miles to the east of us in Athens, Georgia. A great university has a great social movement beginning the UGA Living Wage Campaign. I believe they're represented here tonight.
Jim O'Brien, who probably is not even in the room. He's probably sitting out at the table. Is that right? Yes. But without him, we may have had a conference, but whatever level of organization we have, I think is greatly due to his efforts and his work. So I'm sorry he's not in here, but... Boys Against the War were historians not affiliated with the American Historical Association exactly because they thought we were too partisan an organization to be affiliated with the American Historical Association. However, I will say that we actually worked on and got passed for the first time in its entire history a resolution against the war. And I want to say how pivotal this is. It's pivotal because during the Vietnam War, people like Stout and Lind, also a member of Historians Against the War, attempted to pass the resolution. It was not passed. And I think it's possibly because the HA and the membership has shifted a little bit. That's for sure. But I just think it's really important. And HA as an organization started in January 2003 American Historical Association, and to be a member of Historians Against the War, all you need to do is sign a statement. And to date, 2,470 people have signed that statement. So we want to get it over 3,000, but we're still going. So I'm really very happy to be here with everybody. And now, Ian, are you going to say what's going to happen?
Yeah.
Okay, Ian's going to say what's going to happen then. Okay.
We're going to hear from Bill Fletcher Jr. and from Naomi Klein, and then after they both have spoken, they will answer questions from the audience together. I think what I'll do now is introduce Bill, and we'll move on to his talk. Bill Fletcher Jr. is the executive editor of the Black Commentator, co-founder of the Black Radical Congress and the Center for Labor Renewal, and a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies. For 2 years, he was the Bell Zeller Visiting Professor at Brooklyn College, City University of New York. From January 2002 through April 2006, he served as the President and Chief Executive Officer of Trans-Africa Forum, a national nonprofit organization educating and advocating for policies in favor of the peoples of Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America. Bill's background involves both labor and community struggles. He served as education director and later assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO. Bill's union staff experience has also included the Service Employees International Union, where his last position was assistant to the president for the East and the South. He served as the organizational secretary and administrative director for the National Postal Mail Handlers Union and was an organizer for District 65 United Auto Workers in Boston, Massachusetts. Bill got his start in the labor movement as a rank-and-file member of the Industrial Union of Marine and Shipbuilding Workers of America. Combining labor and community work, he was also involved in ongoing efforts to desegregate the building trades in Boston. While in Boston, he also served as an adjunct faculty member with the Labor Studies Program of the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Bill received his undergraduate education at Harvard University. He has authored numerous articles published in a variety of books, newspapers, and magazines. He is also the co-author of the pictorial booklet, The Indispensable Ally, Black Workers and the Formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, 1934 to 1941. He is the co-author, along with Fernando Gapacin, of the forthcoming book, and I really want to underline how welcome this book will be when it reaches the bookstores. Of Solidarity Divided. It'll be published by the University of California Press next month, which focuses on the crisis of organized labor in the USA. And if I know Bill, it focuses not just on the crisis, but also on the opportunity and the challenge ahead. Tonight he will be speaking on Empire and Race, the Double Helix. Bill Fletcher.
Thank you very much. Good evening. It's always good to be introduced by another Fletcher. I'm really glad to be here, and I want to thank Historians Against the War and the other co-sponsors of this conference for inviting me. And I'm very pleased and honored to be on the same platform with Naomi Klein, a person I have just utmost respect for and admire very much. In thinking about, it was interesting when Ian and Jim and I were corresponding about what I was going to discuss tonight, this theme came to me, which was great. Then I had to try to fill in, well, what exactly am I going to say? And all of a sudden, it occurred to me that Aimé Césaire, in Discourse on Colonialism, published originally in 1959, had a section that I thought was a very appropriate way to begin my talk. So I want to borrow from Césaire, if you'll bear with me. He says as follows: first, we must study how colonization works to decivilize the colonizer, to brutalize him in the true sense of the word, to degrade him, to awaken him to buried instincts, to covetousness, violence, race hatred, and moral relativism. And we must show that each time a head is cut off or an eye put out in Vietnam, and in France they accept the fact. Each time a little girl is raped, and in France they accept the fact. Each time a Madagascan is tortured, and in France they accept the fact. Civilization acquires another dead weight. A universal regression takes place. A gangrene sets in. A center of infection begins to spread. And that, at the end of all these treaties that have been violated, all these lies that have been propagated, all these punitive expeditions that have been tolerated, all these prisoners who have been tied up and interrogated, all these patriots who have been tortured, at the end of all the racial pride that has been encouraged, all the boastfulness that has been displayed, a poison has been distilled into the veins of Europe. And slowly but surely, the continent proceeds towards savagery. And then one fine day, the bourgeoisie is awakened by a terrific boomerang effect. The Gestapos are busy, the prisons fill up, the torturers standing around the racks invent, refine, discuss. People are surprised, they become indignant. They say, how strange, but never mind, it's Nazism, it will pass. And they wait and they hope. And they hide the truth from themselves that it is barbarism, the supreme barbarism, the crowning barbarism that sums up all the daily barbarisms, that it is Nazism, yes, but that before they were its victims, they were its accomplices. That they tolerated that Nazism before it was inflicted on them, that they absolved it, shut their eyes to it, legitimized it, because until then it had been applied only to non-European peoples. That they have cultivated that Nazism, that they're responsible for it, and that before engulfing the whole edifice of Western Christian civilization in its reddened waters, it oozes, seeps, and trickles from every crack. Yes, it would be worthwhile to study clinically in detail the steps taken by Hitler and Hitlerism, and to reveal to the very distinguished, very humanistic, very Christian bourgeois of the 20th century that without his being aware of it, he has a Hitler inside him, that Hitler inhabits him, that Hitler is his demon, that if he rails against him, he is being inconsistent, and that at bottom, what he cannot forgive Hitler for is not the crime in itself, the crime against man, is not the humiliation of man as such. It is the crime against the white man, the humiliation of the white man, and the fact that he applied to Europe colonialist procedures, which until then had been reserved exclusively for the Arabs of Algeria, the coolies of India, and the niggers of Africa. We gather together at a critical moment for the world's greatest empire. It is, however, a paradoxical situation, being both very powerful and very vulnerable. The facts of the current economic situation are across the news media. Yet understanding why the situation has not translated into the sort of resistance movement that one could logically expect necessitates an analysis that goes to the core of the very existence of the United States. While it is absolutely true that the crisis of socialism, exemplified by events such as the collapse of the Soviet bloc and the turn toward capitalism by China, have contributed toward a sense among many that capitalism may be triumphant, the deeper problem goes to the soul of the U.S. itself, and that soul is linked to the interrelationship of empire, race, and indeed settlerism. Time does not permit an exhaustive analysis of any of these categories, but I would offer a few thoughts on each and then conclude with the possible implications for us in the dawn of the 21st century. As the late Theodore Allen, along with other theorists such as Lerome Bennett Jr. and David Roediger, have noted, race as a social construct rather than a fact of biology was introduced first in Ireland and later in the United States as a means of accomplishing two projects. The first, of course, was to justify, in the case of Ireland, the all-round suppression of the indigenous people. The second project was to drive a wedge between the indigenous Irish and the poor settlers sent there by the English crown, thereby creating a bond between the settler and the crown that has lasted over 500 years. In the case of the 13 colonies and later the United States, race became a means to justify the African slave trade and the exploitation of African labor. It also became a means to justify the wars of annihilation against the First Nations, Native Americans, and eventually the war of aggression against Mexico and the demonization of the Asian. But just as in Ireland, it became a means of social control over the laboring population, slave and free, ensuring a lasting bond between, in this case, the white settler laborer and the white settler employer elite. The relative differential in treatment between the white laborer and African slave was critical in that the white laborer, while always being susceptible to bondage, was never eligible to become a slave. This bond was enforced over the years, in fact, taking decades to put into place, despite the resistance of Africans and Europeans, at least initially. What is not sufficiently discussed, though, is the obvious fact that the United States is founded, or was founded, as a settler state. That is, what was once British North America was not the evolution of a formerly feudal kingdom into a semi-capitalist and then fully capitalist society. The British Empire expanded, as we know, and established a system that has parallels in other parts of the world which were victimized by British colonialism. It is in the essence of the settler state that one discovers additional obstacles to overcoming the consciousness and practices so graphically described by Césaire. British-shaped colonialism placed no value, for example, on a mestizo group, that is a mixed European and Native American population. Contrary to Spanish and Portuguese colonialism, the British set out to destroy the First Nations altogether. While it is true that in the Caribbean, the British utilized mulattoes as an intermediary group for purposes of social control, British North America was a settler colony where the objective of the British was not simply to produce goods to ship back to Europe, but as a locale to establish a new social formation, what would eventually be the United States. U.S. capitalism then has at its foundations racist oppression and settlerism, both with intertwining ideologies and practices. In settlerism, and one can see this throughout the world, wherever there's a settler state, there are very interesting qualities, and I want to make note of three. One is relativism. Settler ideology has only one absolute, whatever is good for the settler. The famous example of this relativism can be found in the sagas of the wars against the First Nations. When Indians would win a battle, of course, it would be declared by whites to have been a massacre. When the whites would win, the whites would declare it a military victory. But this can also be seen in treaties. Between 1783 and 1868, there were well over 300 treaties signed by the United States with various Native American tribes. Overwhelmingly, these treaties were broken by the whites when it was to their advantage to do so. A second feature, religious and quasi-religious myth. Settler states are generally speaking inspired by religious or quasi-religious myths. The settler, of course, is the center of the universe, and normally God is alleged to have had a role in this story. God supposedly grants the land to the settler to do with what he or she wants. God, in each case, seems to have a direct line with the settlers, because the indigenous never seem to hear God's voice. Connected to this is the myth that the land had been abandoned or was not being used by the indigenous people, if they were there at all. A third feature, racial superiority. A key ingredient is that the settler, a white from Europe, is superior to the indigenous people in all aspects. This superiority is demonstrated in many ways, not the least of which is military victories over the indigenous. The racial superiority can play itself out in a racial hierarchy, as we've seen in the United States. In the history of the U.S., then, race and settlerism are a firm foundation for the drive towards empire. For the U.S., that empire began as a continental enterprise rather than the establishment of overseas territories. It is worth noting that the founding fathers, so-called, for the founding fathers, there was no contradiction between a republic and an empire any more than there was a contradiction between democracy and slavery. In the racial settler mindset, the only relevant population was the white. And as long as they were not enslaved, there was a democracy. And as long as they were not controlled by a foreign power, they represented a free republic. The drive toward empire in the U.S. was so fascinating because it was largely done without the use of the word empire. And if the word was used, it was more descriptive. There was instead the tremendous use of euphemism, as one sees in the Monroe Doctrine and in the subsequent amended version of the Monroe Doctrine by Teddy Roosevelt in the early 20th century. For the U.S., empire was driven largely through economic relations reinforced by military might. In that sense, Thomas Friedman's famous notion that there is no McDonald's without McDonnell Douglas, and there is no hidden hand without the hidden fist, is not a description of neoliberal capital, but instead a description of the history of capitalism in general, and definitely a history of U.S. capitalism. In a settler mind, the U.S. was advancing civilization and removing obstacles to civilization. This was true for them, irrespective of whether they were destroying the First Nations, enslaving Africans, or stepping on Latin Americans and Filipinos. There was no one to hold a settler accountable because, at least in the settler's myth, they were only to be held accountable by God. And after all, God had given them a mission to go forth and conquer the land, whether in this case the land was North America or in an alternative setting, whether it was the Boers conquering South Africa. Race, settlerism, and empire have become such relevant categories in understanding not only the Iraq War, but for that matter, all U.S. foreign policy. In fact, I would argue that one cannot understand U.S. foreign policy, even if one claims to be on the left, without grasping the role of race, settlerism, and empire in the construction of the U.S. social formation. Insofar as race and settlerism numb many of us to the sufferings of other people, it becomes easier for us to understand the complacency that we see in the face of criminality. The experiences and lives of the global South are simply irrelevant. They are experiences and lives that really do not count. At best, and we saw this in the aftermath of the great Southeast Asian tsunami a couple of years ago, those of the global South are no more than a brown mass that can barely be understood by North Americans, read that, white North Americans, until and unless it is explained to us by other North Americans, or at least by Europeans. The daily reports of death and destruction in Iraq become background noise. Unless it is our children who are being killed, it is only a stat, some sort of perverse baseball game where one keeps the statistics, watches the players, and hopes that the home team wins at the end of the day. You know, I come out of and am very much a part of organized labor. And within organized labor, there's a recurring tendency to believe that working people can somehow be inoculated against what are often called wedge issues. Many wedge issues are connected to race, settlerism, and empire. The idea is simple. For this inoculation, describe to people how they're getting screwed by the rich and the corporations, and they will get furious and bring forth a mass resistance movement. Well, people often do become furious, and yes, they often do turn against the rich and the corporations, but they do not necessarily do that from a progressive or left standpoint. They may just as easily be won to right-wing populism and start to describe the enemy as the Jew, the black, the gay, or the immigrant, and unite those categories with the notion of the rich. But they might not even get that far. They may be furious, but insofar as they hold onto the prerogative of empire and the superiority of the settler, they can ignore other concerns, all in the name of patriotism, in the name of defending the empire. This is not just a U.S. phenomenon. You can see the same thing in other empires, but that goes beyond the scope of my talk. So let me conclude with this suggestion. A great man once said, if you do not hit it, it won't fall. There is no way to inoculate against race, settlerism, and imperial consciousness. These must be taken on and taken out. No, I'm not talking about yelling at people. I'm speaking about engaging in a combination of struggles and political education that challenges these ideologies and practices. This means confronting institutions and policies that reinforce racist oppression, that reinforce settlerism, and reinforce imperialism. It means drawing connections so that we can move away from this naive sense that actions, such as the war in Iraq, are accidental or divergences from an otherwise clean U.S. foreign policy. It is just this point that got Reverend Wright into so much trouble. He was, like so many other African Americans who have seen the underside of the American dream, drawing what I would call forbidden connections. That is, connections based on an analysis derived from our own cold and brutal experiences in North America. He was pointing out that the ambitions of the United States are not noble, but are driven by other forces such as greed and avarice. For telling this plain truth, he was demonized in some sectors and quietly and not so quietly applauded in others. At a mass level, we must fight for a different foreign policy, what I've been calling for years a democratic foreign policy with a small d, which actually alters the relationship between the U.S. and the rest of the world. This is admittedly a reform since we are located in the center of a global empire, but it is a badly needed reform if we are in any way to support the efforts of people around the world to achieve national self-determination, lasting peace, and a sustainable environment. To do this, my friends, means also stepping away from the racial settler precipice, where we privilege our experiences over the rest of the world, where we privilege our hurt over the hurt experiences throughout the world, hurt that's often brought about at the hands of the United States, where we privilege our right to uphold a living standard that is often abetted by outright theft. No, this is no call for poverty, but it is a call for domestic and global equity. And this must be introduced into all of our discussions about foreign policy, including, but not limited to, discussions concerning Iraq. Thank you very much.
And I just wanted to add, since I didn't in the beginning, I was on an American flight, so I got here really late, and I'm a little frazzled. So anyway, I forgot to say that the reason Historians Against the War began was to oppose the war, and it's also because we feel, as historians, that we have a particular responsibility, and I think we have a particular position in society, which gives us that particular responsibility, both in terms of our students, but in terms of the world as large, as sort of public intellectuals, to play more of an engaged role within society and to state our opposition to the war. I'm now going to have a very great pleasure, indeed honor, to introduce Naomi Klein. She is an award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, and author of the New York Times, an international bestseller, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. It was published worldwide in September 2007, and it has, to date, has been translated into over 20 languages. The six-minute companion film, created by Alfonso Cuarón, director of Children of Men, was an official selection of the 2007 Venice Biennale and Toronto International Film Festivals, and was a viral phenomenon, downloaded over a million times. Her first book, No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies, was also an international bestseller, translated into over 28 languages, with more than a million copies in print. A collection of her work, Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate, was published in 2002. Naomi Klein writes a regular column for The Nation and The Guardian, English Guardian, that is syndicated internationally by the New York Times Syndicate. In 2004, her reporting from Iraq for Harper's Magazine won the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism. Also in 2004, she co-produced The Take with director Avi Lewis, and it was a featured documentary about Argentina's occupied factories. The film was an official selection of the Venice Biennale and won the Best Documentary Jury Prize at the American Film Institute's Film Festival in Los Angeles. She is a former Miliband Fellow at the London School of Economics and holds an honorary Doctor of Civil Law from the University of King's College, Nova Scotia. And the title of her presentation tonight is Historical Memory and Shock Resistance. Please join me in welcoming Naomi Klein.
Wonderful to be with you, and it is an honor and a great challenge to follow that platonically perfect speech by Bill Fletcher. It's the kind of speech after which you just go, is there anything more that needs to be said? I really wanted to be here tonight because the work of Historians Against the War is so connected to the work I've been doing on shock. And also because I think it is so important that we maintain groups like this that are overtly anti-war. And particularly in this election year, no matter how you decide to intersect with the election, the idea that we still need to be an independent, tough, clear anti-war voice that is pressuring the candidates from the left for immediate withdrawal is absolutely indispensable. So I want to congratulate you for choosing this year to have your second gathering. It's also exciting to be here in Atlanta, where the US Social Forum took place. I don't know how many of you were there for that. That certainly reverberated around the world and sent a message that there are people in this country willing to tackle those issues that Bill laid out for us so clearly. And that's a crucial message to send, even if it was completely ignored. we know it happened, right? So I am going to be talking a little bit about the themes in the shock doctrine, but I am going to be talking about them specifically as they intersect with the mandate of your organization and why you've all gathered here this weekend. The shock doctrine grew out of reporting that I did in Iraq in the first year of the occupation. Specifically that piece in Harper's Magazine, which was called Baghdad Year Zero, and I called it that, to capture the theory behind what was supposed to happen in Iraq. You know, we often hear that there was no plan, that it was entirely incompetent. But of course, the thesis of the piece was that there was a plan, and the plan was to reboot Iraq, to start over from scratch, from zero, to wipe clean the country of its culture, of its history, of its rootedness, and build a model country where Iraq used to be. And in fact, this idea of the model country was used explicitly and shamelessly in many an op-ed by people like Thomas Friedman, who said quite proudly that in their opinion it didn't really matter which Middle Eastern country was chosen for the project of building a model country in the heart of the Arab world, which would serve as a model, creating, in the phrase of one American Enterprise Institute scholar, I use that word advisedly, a tsunami of democracy throughout the region, radiating outwards from Iraq. And so there was this sort of casual idea from Thomas Friedman, Michael Ledeen, saying, you know, it could be Iraq, it could be Iran, it could be Lebanon. And Iraq was convenient for various reasons to be the model. But of course, that lack of confrontation with the history of this country as a settler state and the violence of the idea of creating a model country in someone else's land, was embedded in the idea of the Iraq invasion from its very start. So now all of these model country builders turn around and say, well, we didn't know. But the flip side of that blank slate idea, that idea of building a perfect country on a blank slate that doesn't exist, the idea of terra nullius, is always the scorched earth. The flip side of the blank slate is always the scorched earth, because reality never complies with these racist fantasies. People refuse to be blanked, to be wiped out. And so they resist, and so they must be wiped out further, blanked further, with greater violence. So the way I understood that first year of occupation in Iraq was as an intersection between three different kinds of shock, which were all based on a similar theory of wiping the slate clean and starting from scratch, which is so embedded not just in the colonial state that is this country and my country, Canada, but also is so embedded in Judeo-Christian mythology. It is the idea of the great flood. Don't like the world you're in right now? We'll just bring on the water, pack your friends on a boat, you know, and we'll get the hell out of here. Or the great rapture that will take you and your friends, airlift them to the gated city in the sky. I mean, these are the myths, and that is why religion and colonialism have always formed such a fruitful partnership, because these particular mythologies, and I realize they can be interpreted in progressive ways, but these particularly vengeful forms of interpreting the use of disaster as God's will, it proves a particularly potent enabler to the colonial project. So in Iraq, you had the first shock, which was the military shock, called shock and awe, designed specifically to imitate the overwhelming strategies of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the Blitzkrieg. If you read the Shock and Awe Manual, those are its reference points. Those are its reference points. And the idea was to create total disorientation. And in fact, if you read the Shock and Awe Military Manual, it is a war crime, because it says specifically that the goal is not to target military targets, but the, and this is a quote, the population writ large, which is, of course, collective punishment, which is illegal. That was the shock and awe strategy. Then immediately after shock and awe, you had the arrival of Paul Bremer with a very specific plan. Yes, a bad plan, but a plan nonetheless. And the plan was to turn Iraq into a booming free market economy. One of his first statements made, Paul Bremer in his Brooks Brothers suits and Timberland boots, was that Iraq is open for business. He had flung open Iraq's borders to absolutely unrestricted free trade. He wrote 100 laws making Iraq the most liberalized economy in the world. The wish list of foreign investors was the phrase that the Financial Times used. So there was a plan and there is a paper trail for what was done in Iraq. Now, of course, it didn't work. The theory was that Iraqis would be so disoriented by the shock and awe invasion that they would just go along with this sort of extreme country makeover. And I use this not to be flip, but I actually think that there is some weird intersection between the fact that we had an explosion of this reality TV genre, which in a way, you know, is this sort of entertainment version of the colonial dream of total reinvention, a blanking of our personal slates, of our houses, our wardrobes, ourselves, having experts come in and just completely remake us while we passively, maybe they ship us off to Hawaii, but whatever it is, we really aren't involved. It's a very, very passive project. And, you know, when I was in Iraq interviewing the people who were in charge of Iraq's reconstruction for the CPA, they would pretend to be completely confused when I asked them why Iraqi engineers weren't being hired on any of the projects. They would say things like, this is a gift from the American people. to the Iraqi people. And their role was not even to unwrap the gift, because of course that was done by contract workers who were brought in from Nepal. They were supposed to do absolutely nothing, except for just be awed by American engineering prowess, which didn't go that well, as we know. But in the same way that they were first supposed to be awed by American weaponry, by American military prowess, then they were to be awed by American engineering and building and technological prowess. Now, when this didn't work, then you had the third shock, which is a much less metaphorical shock, the shock to bodies, the shock of torture. And you see very clearly in the chronology of that first year in Iraq that it was in large part a response to these draconian economic measures that deepened unemployment to a rate of 70%, and which was seen by Iraqis as an extension of the war, that it was really only after these economic measures that a resistance that had started off small, an armed resistance that started off small, became widespread. And that's when the war moved into the jails and torture became systematic. So what this left me with was really a desire to understand the theory of shock, how it's supposed to work, why it is such a seductive metaphor. And I wasn't quite sure how to research this, and so I started by reading psychiatric manuals about the history of the use of electroshock in psychiatry, and that led me to the use of electroshock in torture, because of course there's an intersection there, because psychiatric patients were the test subjects. Actually, in the city where I was born, Montreal, there was a huge CIA-funded experiment at a large psychiatric hospital, the Allen Memorial Hospital, where the CIA funded the director of the hospital to test what would happen to his patients if he dosed them with massive doses of electroshock combined with LSD and PCP. And the idea was that they would blank their personalities, regress them completely, and then implant new healthy personalities. Tell me if this sounds familiar in any way. And I read the CIA manuals that came out of these experiments, that came out of the MKUltra, the huge MKUltra research project. And these are the Kubark manuals and later the 1983 manual that was used in Latin America. And they really are interesting in the way that they systematize the goal of total regression of the personality. And really they are a guidebook to unmaking people, to unmaking personality, sensory deprivation, sensory overload. But what's so interesting when you read these manuals is that if you really want to gain control over an individual, you need to sever them from their narrative. That's the message that comes up over and over and over again. You need to sever them, and this is where I think it intersects with your work. You need to sever them from their personal history, their sense of where they are in time and space. And that's why things like depriving prisoners of comfort items are so important, and photographs, and anything that reminds, that is that link to a narrative that makes sense. And you have all of these pieces of advice in the manuals, like create confusion between day and night. And of course, we've seen all of these methods used since September 11th very clearly on people like Jose Padilla, who wasn't allowed a mirror or a calendar, as this deliberate disorientation strategy. Now, when I was reading these manuals, I had a sort of strange reaction to them, which was that it reminded me so much of how we collectively responded to September 11th. I felt like I was reading a description of what happened to us as a society, that state of mass regression that so many of us went into. The CIA manuals begin with this preface that says, everything we are about to describe is essentially a technique for inducing regression. And then it explains how the interrogator is going to become the father figure. And that just reminded me of that terrible moment when lots of people I respected thought Rudy Giuliani was their long-lost daddy. And this thing, you know, we use this phrase shock quite casually. You know, I was in a state of shock to describe how we feel in these moments. But a state of shock, really what it is the moment when we lose our narrative. It's the moment when we lose our collective story. It is literally the gap that opens up between an event and our ability to explain that event. And so what we heard so many times after September 11th, it seemed to come from nowhere, right? As if it was an attack from outer space. That is what was so shocking about it. You know, and Arundhati Roy wrote at the time that the terrible fact is that, you know, that Americans have woken up to realize that they are at war with people whose names they don't know. And actually, I'm misquoting her right now, so I shouldn't be quoting her like that. But that was the feeling of disorientation, of not knowing who or why was so angry at this country. Now, the natural impulse in that moment, the human impulse, the sane impulse, was to get oriented really fast. And I'm sure many of you remember as historians that there was a tremendous hunger for history in that moment. The people were rushing to libraries and bookstores trying to fill that gap that had made them so vulnerable, to get oriented in time and space. And there was a tremendous process of popular education in that moment, of people gathering, talking, trying to incorporate this event into a narrative that would make sense. Now, one of the things that was interesting that happened at that period actually is that Chomsky had this amazing revival, right? And so did Howard Zinn, and people were researching the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and they were researching CIA support for the Muslim Brotherhood, and all of this was going online, and some people were going back further, and they were learning about the Nakba for the first time. And then the Bush administration did something very interesting, which is not just declare a war on terror, but declare a war on history. And these were simultaneous wars. And I'm sure you remember it all too well, that moment when we learned that the very act of doing what it is that we all do, which is contextualize, suddenly became a treasonous act. To contextualize these events, to say that they actually took place within a narrative, to try to fill in those pieces, was, we were told, an act of rationalizing the terror itself. Was to collaborate with a terrorist, was to be a terrorist in this new framework, which was a very frightening thing to be, because of course the rules were all changing in that moment of disorientation, and none of us knew what that would mean. So we also had that rebooting moment, the rebooting of history, and we started to hear these phrases like pre-9/11 thinking. That phrase came up within days of the 9/11 attacks, pre-9/11 thinking. And the message was very, very clear. Everything that you thought you knew before these attacks no longer applies. And you know, I felt this very keenly at the time because I, as some of you know, was very much a part of the movement against corporate globalization. That was erroneously called the anti-globalization movement, and that had been very, very strong and very much in the news in the lead up to 9/11. You had just that summer huge protests in Genoa, July 2001. A couple months earlier, in April 2001, there had been huge demonstrations in Quebec City against the free trade area of the Americas. And I always remember that there was a headline on September the 12th in a national newspaper in Canada. And the headline was, "Globalization is so yesterday." because there was this anxiousness to bury that whole economic debate that movement represented. The fact that we were debating global capitalism in the streets around the world, and the system was really laid bare. We were not talking just about American empire. We were talking about a global system of capitalism in every single country in the world, and identifying and targeting the institutions that were disseminating this ideology of rampant privatization, deregulation, cuts to social spending. We were told that none of this mattered anymore. Well, it certainly seems to to matter today. So it was the rebooting, the beginning of history. None of our stories mattered anymore because we had new stories. At the same time as we were blanked and reborn post 9/11, we got these new ready-made narratives, clash of civilizations, the axis of evil, the war against Islamofascism. And of course, you had many people, many professional experts in the media who were all too happy to have new stories, because there's nothing that an expert hates more than not knowing everything. So that frightening moment of vertigo that the attacks represented was able to pass very quickly with this brand new worldview handed down, courtesy of Bernard Lewis et al. So I think that this shook the confidence of many progressives, of many people on the left. And this lack of confidence in our own narratives, in our ability to explain the world, extended into the kind of anti-war movement that we chose to build in those early days, I think for understandable reasons. But there was a sense that it was too divisive to talk about Iraq and Afghanistan, or even 9/11 within a broader economic or even historical context, that we would just start now and we would just try to stop these bombs, and that was the one thing that we could all agree on. And so part of what happened, I think particularly in North America, is that you had a progressive movement that really splintered into, and I'll just talk about two areas that it broke into. One would be the sort of the people who had been talking about globalization and economics and corporate dominance before 9/11 continued to do so, but sort of ignored the war and became more sort of policy wonk and less connected to movements, because of course the energy of movements and where people wanted to be in the streets was stopping the wars. And so then you had the anti-war movements saying, okay, we're just going to stop these wars, but we don't want to talk about economics because that's too divisive. So you had this parting of the ways, and I would argue that that weakened both movements significantly. Now, I came to the conclusion that part of what was weakening our movements was that many of us, and I know this isn't true of all of us, but that many of us had an inadequate understanding of the role that violence and shock had played in creating and advancing the economic model that we had been protesting outside the World Trade Organization, the IMF, the World Bank, the G8, and so on. That we had essentially bought the idea that neoliberalism, though brutal and damaging, was actually a more peaceful phase of history than previous blood-soaked eras. And so while we may have known that capitalism had been an extraordinarily brutal and bloody enterprise in its colonial days, we were less able to make the connections between the advancing of the contemporary stage of capitalism that we're in, of neoliberalism, which I'll define in this context as the era that we've been living since Reagan. In other parts of the world, you would date it back earlier to the 70s in Latin America. But essentially, the revolt against the progressive responses to the Great Depression around the world, a class war. That is the stage of capitalism that we have been living in, that we've been fighting in this so-called anti-globalization movement, and that we had not adequately looked at the level of violence that had been required to advance this economic model. And so when it suddenly was advancing through tremendous violence in Iraq, and later by using devastating natural disasters like the Asian tsunami and Hurricane Katrina, we didn't have an adequate framework to discuss it. Now, I happened to be in Argentina when the war in Iraq began, making the film that was mentioned earlier, The Tape. I went to Argentina after the economic crisis at the end of 2001, when the currency collapsed, and many of you probably remember those scenes of middle-class Argentines banging with pots and pans in the streets and banging on bank machines trying to get their money out because they were locked out of their bank accounts. It was and they overthrew five presidents in 3 weeks. We decided to make a documentary film about that. And it was very interesting to be in Argentina in 2002, 2003, in the war buildup period, and to look at the war through the eyes of my Argentinian friends, because of course they saw some very, very strong continuities that were less clear to us in North America. And you know, when we had the huge anti-war marches ahead of the Iraq War, I went to the ones in Buenos Aires because that's where I was living at the time. And what I kept hearing in the streets was, they did this to us. They did this to us, you know, 30 years ago. And at the time, I didn't really understand exactly what that meant, because as far as I knew, Argentina had never been bombed by the US. But the more I talked to people, the more I became acquainted with the Latin American analysis that neoliberalism had come with blood and fire, that the shocks of the military coups in the 70s had been followed with brutal economic shock therapy enforced with torture, just as it had been in Iraq. So the research I ended up doing was to try to bring out that continuity between the bloody roots of the neoliberal project that began under Pinochet as the first laboratory for the Chicago Boys, and then spread throughout the Southern Cone with tremendous violence, and look at these patterns, these recurring patterns of the use of shock and terror and disorientation to advance this ideological project. So I'm not going to get into it in much more depth here, because I want to have time for a discussion. But one of the things I do want to bring out, because of the moment that we're in, I mean, in the book I talk about the Tiananmen Square massacre and how crucial it was for creating a context of terror for Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms, and that it really wouldn't have been possible to turn China into the sweatshop of the world without the terror that was spread through the massacre. I think these are clear examples, but less clear is the way that economic shocks have been used. Moments of extreme economic disorientation to prepare the ground for neoliberalism. The classic example, or the most dramatic example, would be the Volcker shocks, the Volcker interest rate shocks, and the debt shocks throughout the 80s. And the way that was used for structural adjustment, and then more recently, in the 1997-98 Asian economic crisis. And very deliberate strategies that were used in Washington at the IMF to allow that economic crisis to deepen so that the IMF could come in and create the world's largest fire sale out of the economies of South Korea, Thailand, the Philippines, and Indonesia. Now, this is very important because, you know, a deep economic crisis can simulate the conditions of a war, especially if it's an economic crisis born of speculative finance, because that has that same quality of total disorientation. You go from being an Asian tiger economy, the toast of the world economy, right? You know, one minute, all you're hearing is that these are the most successful economies in the world, and the next minute, they are literally tanking. You know, in the interviews with people in 97-98 in Asia, it was the confusion about how this had even happened, the sense of unreality that you could go from a booming economy to a basket case so quickly is what strengthened the hand so much of the IMF to come in and make all of these draconian demands. Now, I'm going to come back to the use of economic crisis for obvious reasons, because we're facing one, and the shock doctors are at it again. But first I want to talk a little bit about the good news, which is that this doesn't always work by any means. These shock tactics, these disorientation tactics, do not always work. But what we see is that deep historical memory is the most effective form of shock resistance, precisely because shock is about surprise. It's about that absence of story, that absence of narrative to explain events. So societies that actually do have a powerful narrative, a powerful historical memory, are far more resistant to these opportunistic strategies of taking advantage of that moment of disorientation. People who know their history are able, obviously, to identify the patterns as the exploitation is unfolding, to call it out, and also to provide alternatives. The other thing that you see again and again in terms of what makes a society shock resistant is deep suspicion of the state. I realize this isn't good news necessarily in the context of what Bill just said about American nationalism, but shock does put us into that childlike state where we want to trust the goodness of our authority figures. So those who have an inherent, hard-earned, deep distrust of the state, of authority figures, tend to be far more resilient in the face of these tactics for obvious reasons. Now, I'll just draw one example from Argentina, because I was talking about it earlier. When we were there making the documentary, we actually had not been there when the first rebellion happened. We came a few weeks later. So we asked a lot of people to describe what it had been like on December 19th and 20th, which were the days of the cacerolazos, when there were millions of people in the streets banging pots and pans. And the story that we heard, I think, is quite relevant to the moment that we're living. I hope it's not too relevant. But the story that we heard was, of course, Argentina's economy was spiraling. People were locked out of the banks. There was looting in the suburbs. And on December 19th, Fernando de la Rúa, the president of Argentina, went on television, and he said, "There are enemies of this country that are trying to destroy. They're trying to destroy us. You need to stay in your houses." He imposed a curfew, and he declared a state of siege. And while he was doing this, in the middle of this televised address of the president declaring a state of siege, people started to hear their neighbors in the street banging pots and pans. And they went into their kitchens, and they grabbed a pot and pan and left their television sets on, you know, with their president droning on about how they should stay in their houses. And it converged and wordlessly, but very loudly, made their way to the Plaza de Mayo and the Congress and banged and banged and banged and banged until de la Rúa was airlifted in helicopter. And it went on. But what was interesting, talking to Argentinians about this moment, we heard the same thing over and over again. When we asked them why there was this instant response, they said because it reminded us of 1976. That when he declared the state of siege, they remembered that that was how the military dictatorship had started in 76, that it was precisely the promise of security in the face of the forces of chaos that had been so seductive. Because, of course, in 76 it was a gentleman's coup, and it was welcomed by many people in Argentina who were afraid of the chaos, afraid of left-wing guerrillas, and so on. And they said, we weren't going to let it happen again. So in the moment that it was happening, they identified it without talking to their friends, without reading articles, without even text messaging each other. They actually just knew. Now, another example that I'm sure many of you took note of was in Spain in 2004, when Madrid was hit by that devastating terrorist attack, which many Spaniards refer to as their 9/11. And José María Aznar, their right-wing president, did his best George Bush impersonation and just wildly tried to take advantage of it instantly. He blamed ETA. He said, this is why we're in Iraq. The two things really don't add up. If it's ETA, what does it have to do with Iraq? But in general, just fed a climate of fear. And you saw the same phenomenon. Instant mass demonstrations, rallies in the streets of Madrid against fear, which is actually incredibly powerful because in that moment, they didn't know who was behind the attacks. They hadn't arrested them. There was that very familiar fear that people remember after 9/11 of not knowing whether there would be more attacks. So it's frightening to gather in large numbers, but people did it nonetheless because they realized that that was where their strength lied. And as it happened, there were elections the next day, and they voted out Aznar and voted in the Socialist Party. Now, when people in this case were interviewed about why they responded in such a spontaneously cohesive way, you heard the same thing. He reminded us of Franco. Aznar reminded us of Franco, that they identified those early stages of fascism and nipped it in the bud. And one of the things that was interesting about the way that was interpreted, even on the left here, was, well, that's Spain. They have a history of fascism to draw on. We're vulnerable because we don't have any history to draw on, right? And I mean, this was really said with a straight face. And so I think we see in that response how weakened we are in our ability to meet our current challenges by the commitment to forgetting at the heart of the national narrative, at the heart of the national narrative. And I think, you know, I say the national narrative because it's by no means everyone, right? I mean, if you think about the Abu Ghraib photographs and the rivers of ink that were spilled to talk about how incredibly innovative it was that they took pictures as souvenirs of their torture, that this had never been done before, right? And of course, we heard from African American scholars and historians and their allies again and again that this was, of course, not new, and drew the connections with the postcards of lynchings. In New Orleans, when the levees broke, we heard these instant narratives that it was a blessing, perhaps, an opportunity. We heard from Richard Baker, Republican congressman, we couldn't clean out the housing projects, but God did. And of course, this had powerful historical echoes with the settling of this country and the way in which other so-called natural disasters were welcomed, like smallpox, welcomed as the blessed plague that helpfully cleaned the land of its inhabitants, the most fertile land, and handed it over to the pilgrims. I think in this, I think this is particularly relevant, and I'm just going to talk about this very briefly. I don't know how many of you subjected yourselves to the Petraeus testimony, this inability to deal with what an occupation means, and the narrative that we hear from so many Democrats, that it's really the Iraqis' fault, that they just can't get their act together. And this idea of a mismanaged occupation, this idea that the occupation could be managed well if there was someone else in charge, and so on. Now, as you can tell from what I've been saying, I think that you, as historians, have an absolutely crucial role to play as our memory and as our storytellers and as the people with the power, although I realize not the means of amplification, to keep us oriented in these crucial moments, to fill those gaps. And we are in the early stages of another shock. And I think it's a very good time to remind people that after the crash of 1929, so much of what has been dismantled by this 30-year campaign against the state was the progressive response to that market failure, that total market failure. And that we really have been living this war against the gains made by progressives and workers after that crash and after that evident failure of capitalism. We need you to be that historical memory. Many of the candidates are not interested in saying the New Deal for fear of being slammed on right-wing talk shows. But it's a tremendously empowering narrative. It's a tremendously empowering narrative because it isn't just critiquing, it is showing that we can occupy this space. I think it's an inspiring moment in our relatively recent history where we had confidence in one of those moments of disorientation. We had the strength of our convictions. And I think we're in one of those moments where we need those convictions badly. Thank you.
Tonight, so let's just get right to the questions. And I will admit, it's a little awkward. We have this one mic. So Anne and I are going to kind of field the questions, and both Bill and Naomi will answer them. So what we'd like you to do is just put up your hand if you want to talk. And the other problem is you have to speak loudly, so because we don't have a mic to go out to get you. Okay, so go right ahead.
There are many similarities and some differences. I mean, I think this practice of dehumanizing and ritual humiliation and the use of shock, they really are standard prison tactics. And this is where I think the definitions of what is torture also get very, very challenging, because we draw some pretty arbitrary lines here. The uniforms, the nudity. It's also sort of straight out of Foucault. I mean, but there are differences. But I think the differences are less interesting in the sense that there are certain principles around dehumanization and unmaking that are then made specific for specific circumstances. So you have a lot of tactics used in Iraq and used in Guantanamo that are specifically tailored to Muslim prisoners. So maybe they look different than what goes on in an American prison, but the principles of dehumanization are the same. It's just that they are using a sort of, an Arabist, like an Orientalist handbook telling them what is particularly humiliating to an Arab man, and using those tactics in that context. I think it's really less a that it's so much worse than what goes on in an American prison. The other thing I would say is in MKUltra also these drug experiments were done on African American prisoners in the U.S. as well as on psychiatric patients.
Let's see. I'm going to run this back.
Hey, everybody, Joe. I wanted to make a comment about, like, principles of economics. They're referring to derivatives contracts that are closing at a higher value than the actual commodity. Can you explain that?
No.
I think that's a very good answer. Probably the one he was looking for.
It's probably not good.
I'm hoping I can make sense of this. But in this is for Naomi Klein. In the talk you said about, and I was really interested in the disorientation part and this ties in with that. You said the history is important basically because the countries with a strong narrative often resist the disorientation. And so what I was confused about in this is like Iraq seems to have a deep history, or so therefore would have a strong resistance, which we've seen with, you know, car bombings, I think, is a good example of that. So it seems to me that it could be that the possible strategy is once all these shock tactics haven't worked, and this is kind of, I don't know, me trying to make sense of this, that the second strategy after the shock parts haven't really done so much for our neoliberal government is to pit Muslims against each other. And if this is the case, then are we actually working with the current narrative, or at least the stereotype of the original narrative? And does this, I mean, I think this helps us, if the U.S. removes the guilt, if you put two religious groups against each other. I just wondered if any of this played into this disorientation, or if the disorientation only applied to, like, the U.S. being disoriented and actually what's going on in Iraq. If that makes any sense.
It's certainly disorienting. Well, I mean, I don't think the shock and awe strategy ever worked on Iraqis, I think it's actually an American obsession with the idea that you cannot deal with the problem of history, the problem of culture, the problem of people having their own will by just blasting them. It's an extraordinarily simplistic idea. It's simplistic when it's applied to economies. It's simplistic when it's applied to people's brains. And it's simplistic when it's applied to people's countries. So it didn't work. And they have been in damage control ever since. But in Iraq, it didn't work for so many reasons. It does rely on an element of surprise. That's what creates the shock. And if there's one thing Iraqis are not shocked by, it's being attacked by the U.S., you know?
I'm not a historian, but when you talk about the remembering of history, and for me it's been very clear, or maybe mistaken, that that is a real problem in America, the forgetfulness. And also, for example, the history, even if the movement remember the history of Vietnam War, which is maybe recent, they would remember that during the Vietnam War, the American peace movement supported the self-determination of the Vietnamese people to fight the American army with all they could. But today, they do not stand by the right of the Iraqi people for self-determination. And also another part of history, when you refer to the during the 29 and the 20s and Depression era, one reason that the American people were able to respond so tremendously is because there was a tremendous labor and communist movement in America. And during this whole time, there has been so much anti-communist, anti-labor union propaganda in America that in the American peace movement, you see anti-communism and anti-labor unionism. And if we cannot take care of that, then we are in trouble. Thank you.
I want to, just a couple of comments. One is that it's not that we forget in the United States. There's enforced forgetfulness. There are penalties for remembering. And part of what happened with Reverend Wright is that he remembered. And when people remember, they get slapped down. And it's in periods of upsurge that we start to remember. I mean, the 1960s and 70s was a period of remembering. And that's a lot of what the movement was. It was an ideological challenge to the settler myth, to the racial history of the United States, and eventually to the gender history of the United States. But when our movement receded, then the enforced forgetfulness reemerged. I just want to say one thing, though, about the second part. I don't think... I agree with you that in the 1930s, we had communist socialists, we had Mustites, we had Trotskyists that were very, very active in helping to bring about a response to the Depression and other right-wing maneuvers. I don't think that the problem currently in the peace movement, the anti-war movement, is anti-communism at all. I think that the problem is that we don't have a vibrant revolutionary left in the United States that plays the role or anything approximating the role of what the Communist Party, the Mustites, and others did in the 30s. And I don't mean that we don't have groups handing out newspapers. Right? But we don't have the same kind of vehicle for advancing the kind of change that's necessary. And one of the problems in all social movements is that we attempt to try to figure out an answer to our dilemma without addressing the question of the mechanisms that are necessary in order to move the people's movements forward. And it just doesn't happen out of thin air. But it's precisely because of what you were raising. And I think that is critically important. One final comment. I know I said the last one was the final. The other thing about in Vietnam, one of the things that we've got to keep in mind that I think complicates the situation in Iraq compared to many other situations is that in Vietnam, there was the National Liberation Front. There was the National Liberation Front that had a very coherent view, that had active outreach around the world to various forces. In Iraq, we have nothing like that. We have a movement or movements that are very different, and we have movements that are much harder for people in the United States to unite with, for sometimes good reasons and sometimes for terrible reasons. So I think that's a real problem, and it's not just there. One of the experiences I had several years ago after the coup in Haiti was that the absence of a force on the ground in Haiti that could reach out to people in the United States made support work that much more difficult. It just did. It shouldn't be that way, but it did. And in that people were often unclear, how can they actually build support? Who are the good guys on the ground? And this is one of the things that we've got to figure out in terms of the nature of our work against the war. That this problem is a problem that ends up sometimes falling prey to anti-Muslim and anti-Arab biases. So I would just add that that's a difference between our situation and when we were dealing with Vietnam versus the current situation.
One question for Naomi Klein, and then one for Bill Fetcher. For Naomi Klein, could you comment on the extent to which the Israeli regime has been involved in this project of creating a new Middle East from the ground up, and specifically the extent to which the Zionist occupation of Palestine and the attempted creation of a viable apartheid-type setup there is the conscious model for what the U.S. plans for the Middle East as a whole. In other words, the extent to which the two are collaborators from the word go. For Bill Fletcher, can you say something about, since you started your remarks with some words about the economic crisis now unfolding, is it possible to imagine a situation not too far down the road in which the U.S. can literally no longer afford its empire, and this will open some big cracks in the system and some really big opportunities for a reborn labor movement, if it is conscious enough to take advantage of them? And I can't resist adding one other tidbit of good news for those who may have missed it. In the New York Times a couple days ago, story from Egypt about the Egyptian economy. strikes and workers' protests, well, that certainly conflicts with the kind of narrative we've been hearing in the corporate media about the Middle East and its ideology. But that is the face of the new Middle East, one we should welcome, support, and be part of.
Okay, in terms of the, you know, I reject the idea that American foreign policy is subservient to Israeli goals. You know, I think American foreign policy is driven not by American goals, but by the goals of the elites in this country that intersect with Israel's in many, many ways. And you know, including the sense that Israel is essentially the world's largest military base for the U.S., which I think is seen that way by a lot of people in this administration. That said, I think the Israeli government has very consciously, very expertly, and very well, from the earliest days after 9/11, understood that there was an opportunity to recast their occupation and their battle for land against the Palestinians, not as a struggle over land against a people struggling who are struggling against occupation and have national aspirations, but rather against an incoherent Arab mass. And in other words, to recast their, what they call the conflict, within this context of the global war on terror. And I think that that's where you saw a very, very powerful synergy. And then you saw a lot of ideas and tactics trading and a great deal of cooperation, with the Israelis casting themselves as the experts in fighting Arab terror that doesn't have any goals, that wants nothing but the total annihilation. So I think it was very much an intellectual project of casting the attacks on the U.S. as being very similar to Palestinian attacks on Israel. And so I think that's where you see the synergy most clearly.
A couple things. We owe a special debt. We owe the Arab people and the Muslim people. And that's a very unpopular thing to say because of the anti-Arab prejudice and anti-Muslim prejudice in this country, there is this reluctance to recognize, and it goes back to something Naomi was talking about earlier, reluctance to recognize the great damage the United States has done in the Arab and Muslim worlds. Whether it was Iran in 53, Iraq in 63, the Sudan, Egypt, I mean, we can go on and on, where religious and secular left-wing and nationalist movements were violently crushed by allies of the United States, including some of the forces that are currently called jihadists. And so there's a particular debt that we owe that we really do need to acknowledge, and it will be part of the reparations that we have to consider at some point. In terms of the question about can I envision a time when the U.S. can no longer afford the empire? Well, yeah. But the problem is, there was a point when the Romans could no longer afford an empire, and look what happened after that, right? That is, that history is not a straight line of progress, that there are a lot of ways that the road curves. And one of the ways that it can curve in the United States would be the growth of right-wing populism. I mean, I think that there's two distinct right-wing currents that we have to worry about. One is the development of a neoliberal authoritarian state, which we have been seeing since the late 1970s, early 80s, and the growing, the shrinking space for alternative political discourse. But the other piece is right-wing populism. And right-wing populism has a very long history in the United States. And in response to a further economic downturn, I think that right-wing populism is one of the biggest dangers that we have to look out for, because right-wing populism has a very compelling argument. I mean, think about Pat Buchanan, who on the one hand, if he's talking at a certain moment, sounds like he's on the left, and then he says a couple of words and you think Himmler is standing next to him, right? And it's like, whoa! And the problem is we often get this confused, because we'll say, well, we'll take part of what Buchanan is saying, but we'll leave aside the other. No. For the right-wing populace, it's all a part of the same thing. It's all part of the same narrative. And so part of what our task really is struggling against right-wing populism, because it could very well become the major current. I was actually engaged in a discussion with some truckers recently who are involved in these struggles around prices, the price of fuel. And, you know, so I'm listening, I'm on this conference call, and these guys are really militant, right? And talking about, you know, we got to do something, we got to send these trucks into different cities, and blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden he says, and these fucking immigrants. I said, oh, man. You know, it's like you can't get away from it. And we've got to confront it, because it's that hand that comes out of the grave and grabs us by the ankle. Let me make 3 points about that. The settler narrative is basically a narrative principally about white people and specifically about white men. And it's about a defining of what it meant to be a man. And the whole idea, the rugged individualism and the actual division of labor between a man and a woman, this whole thing is, that's central to what how it is that we envision, or how settlerism as a story played itself out. But in the current situation, there's a couple of things that I think that we have to pay a particular attention to. With the rise of neoliberal globalization, there has been an active campaign against women. And it relates back to what I was saying before about right-wing populism. Because you can see in the United States, but you can also see in other parts of the world, and I want to talk specifically about right-wing Islamism, this anti-woman current that is specifically within the right-wing populism. It's the notion that the problem of the declining living standard for the man is directly related to the changing role of the woman. And so within Islam, you have this caricaturization of Islam to become within Islamism specifically, this idea that it is the man first, and this elimination of not only the rights, but the active involvement of women in society. You saw this, for example, in Afghanistan under the Taliban. What the Taliban instituted there had nothing to do with Islam, but it had to do with a male supremacist notion, and in fact, I'd say a fascist notion, of the assertion of the role of the man in response to the declining role of women. Assertion of the role of men in response to the increasing role of women, and the perception that it is the woman that, in fact, is challenging the man and is the reason that men are declining. So you had, for example, in many of these right-wing Islamist groups, a very highly educated, D-class male group that, in fact, look at the problem as compounded by three factors: U.S. imperialism, the corrupt authoritarian regimes, and women. And these three factors are identified as a problem. In the United States, within right-wing populism, we see actually much the same thing. We see this current that became very apparent in the 1980s, particularly in the farm areas, of the rise of these right-wing populist / fascist groups that interpreted the declining living standard of white people as being based both on the rising role of minorities, but also the changing role of the women. So the whole notion of family values is nothing more than a reconstruction of male supremacist dominance. And so I think that this is one of these struggles that when we're talking about combating right-wing populism, it's why it's so important that we're addressing this issue of misogynism. It's not like an add-on to it. It's central to the right-wing populist narrative. So I appreciate the question.
I'd like to ask about the next war and how we respond to that. Obviously, Iran is a big possibility for the next war. But on the left, there are certainly some movements afoot to have U.S. quote do something in Darfur, when, of course, the leading humanitarian crisis in Africa is Somalia, which in great part our government is responsible for putting the current regime in power. How do you think the anti-war movement should, is that a danger that, say, under Obama and the Clinton administration, or even under the McCain administration, there could be an effort to go into another civil war, namely Darfur, where you don't have problems now, suicide bombers and so forth, but you could well get them if you have American forces in there. And is that a danger, and how should the anti-war movement respond to that danger? How should we, is this something that we're too complacent about?
So let me give an answer to that, and then I see people leaving, so maybe we should move to wrap up with one final question, because my feelings get hurt when people start walking out. So one thing, to back up to something that related to what Naomi was raising about shock and awe, this may sound like a real tangent. Since World War II, there has been this struggle in military circles about the issue of air power. And it's a, you notice it's a recurring theme within the military about whether air power can win wars. And what is the role of empire? So you had, for example, Curtis LeMay, that many of you may remember from World War II, but then during Vietnam, talking about bombing people back to the Stone Age. The notion of the next war, part of the debate is whether the next war is an air war. So the air forces believe that an attack on Iran, a massive attack on Iran from the air, is all that's necessary in order to bring Ahmadinejad to his knees. Whereas the forces that are on the ground say, uh-uh, that ain't going to work. Right? But that is a struggle that exists within in the military, and it really goes to incredible illusions about the role of air power. And that was one of the big mistakes in the beginning of the Iraq War. The second thing specifically to your question is that your question goes to part of why I was saying that we've got to understand the roots of U.S. foreign policy. Because insofar as we look at things like Vietnam or Iraq as mistakes, we misunderstand what the U.S. is doing overseas, and we sometimes can find ourselves unwittingly advancing policies that are not very good. A U.S. military action in Darfur would be absolutely horrible. And it would even be horrible from the standpoint of U.S. imperialism. But it would be horrible from the standpoint of the people of the Sudan. Because, among other things, just on a very pragmatic level, U.S. intervention in the Sudan would be immediately described by the al-Bashir clique in Khartoum as aggression. And it would completely change the contours of what's going on in the Sudan. But the second thing, and more fundamental, is that there's many of us that, particularly during the 90s, got seduced by this notion of humanitarian or human rights intervention. And we really misunderstood the motives behind what the United States was doing. And in general, our attitude should be, what do they say with physicians? First, do no harm. That should be the basic thing that we're talking about right now. First, do no harm. That there are things that the U.S. can actually do to support things, but they're not military. There's financial assistance, there's other things that can be done. But the idea of promoting military interventions is absolutely not something that we should encourage. And it would be very, very harmful. Your example of Somalia is very important, because the fact of the matter is that the United States encouraged Ethiopia to invade Somalia, and we have in Somalia right now a horrendous situation in what has been described by a human rights organization recently as one of the least covered but most important human rights disasters on this planet. But the United States collaborates with the Ethiopians. Let's do one last.
Michael Heaney, University of Florida. Thanks for speaking to us tonight.
Thank you.
During the anti-Vietnam War movement, the Black Panthers and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee played out a very important role in mobilizing African-Americans in their opposition to the war. During this current anti-war movement, there haven't been African-American-focused organizations that have played a highly visible role in opposing the war. And I was wondering if you could talk about what the anti-war movement can do to, very practically speaking, include more people of color in the movement. I know that often they're included in the governing boards and steering committees of leading organizations, but often aren't well represented in the rank and file.
Well, there's a few different issues in what you're raising that are very important for us to make note of. So many of the groups that were involved in the anti-war movement around Vietnam subsequently faced tremendous repression. And that is that the Black left suffered great repression at the hands of the U.S. government, particularly through the notorious counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO. And the crushing of the Black left, along with sectarianism within our own ranks, really weakened our abilities to do what needed to be done in the 80s, 90s, and up through today. The second thing is that within Black America, which is something that I focus more on when I'm talking about anti-war work, we have this paradox. We have the greatest anti-war sentiment of any other constituency in this country, the greatest. From the beginning, anti-war sentiment among Black Americans was at a low of about 60%. At a low, right? And you might have noticed over the last few years the reduction in the number of blacks joining the U.S. military. Right? So you have this very deep opposition to the war and distrust of the U.S. The objectives of the U.S. in Iraq. That is not translating into our mobilization, and I think that it's not primarily because of errors on the part of the anti-war movement. And that may be heresy for some people, but I'm gonna just try to make it real as far as I'm concerned. I believe that it has more to do with things that are going on among us as African Americans, and that is the growth of despair that has been the result of more than 20 years of getting our asses kicked, politically and economically, and the reduction in the belief that struggle pays. So there you have, on the one hand, ideological opposition, and people will speak out around the war, but a feeling that we are not in a position to do something about it, which is one of the reasons that groups like the Black Radical Congress, Black Voices for Peace, were and are important in terms of rekindling that. I think that part of what our task is with, you know, those in the black left is really to try to rebuild organizations and rebuild sentiment so that we're taking a lead in the anti-war movement, taking a lead in the global justice movement. If there is something that the white, predominantly white anti-war movement can do, it's to remember one very important thing. There is a big difference between diversity and inclusion. Diversity is how many people are at the table. Inclusion is who's making the decision. And as you know, in many movements, we have the same problem where the table is now much more diverse than it once was. But that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody sitting there has an equal say in the decisions, that there are often meetings that happen after the meeting. And they might happen over the phone. They might happen at breakfast or dinner. They might happen over email. But other decisions get made. And at a certain point, you realize that, well, maybe my activity is not that important anymore here. So I think that we have to rethink the culture of our organizations and our movements. And that's very unsettling because it often means that we have to build things that don't necessarily focus on our friends and build things that don't necessarily focus on the way that we like to do things. I mean, this is something in organized labor that I would encounter all the time, where people would, it was very clear that we, those of us of color, were the fly in the ointment, that we were asking that things be done and discussed in a different way. And in doing this, it unsettled people who might have had very noble intentions but didn't want to be shaken out of their comfort zone. And I think we have to do a little getting out of our comfort zone. Thank you very much.
And it starts tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, although at 8:30 there's breakfast and food.
I don't know who the speakers are. Do you want to see who the speakers are? You don't know? What? I said that.